brought to you by the Fetzer Institute, helping to build a spiritual foundation for a loving world. Welcome, everyone, to the Wonder and Awe podcast, A Journey into the Soul. My guests today are Howard and Michelle Hall, two of the greatest underwater cinematographers and filmmakers, and dear friends of mine. Howard Hall Productions specializes in marine wildlife natural history motion pictures. During the last 40 years, their company has produced numerous exhibit films, broadcast television documentaries, and IMAX theatrical features. Their most recent film, Secrets of the Sea, is now opening in numerous IMAX theaters in the United States and many other theaters around the world. Secrets of the Sea is a co-production between Howard Hall Productions and Oceanic Research Group. The film was produced by Michelle Hall and co-directed by Howard and Jonathan Bird. It's being distributed by McGilvey Freeman Films. Another great film they made is Soul of the Ocean, the first feature film from Howard Hall Productions. In June 2022, it won Best Cinematography at the Blue Water Film Festival, in addition to many awards worldwide. The film has been versioned as an episode of the PBS series Nature and was broadcast in January 2023. This version of the film is now available on the PBS website. Welcome, Howard and Michelle. It's great to see you guys.
Great to see you, Louis.
You know, we've known each other for a long time as fellow film eco-warriors, and we collaborated on the Moving Art series on Netflix, where you created the Underwater and the Whale and Dolphins episode. And then we also worked together on the Tahiti episode, you filming underwater and me filming topside. I think I had the easier job, you know, drinking those margaritas on the beach while you were like struggling underwater. But it was a good collaboration.
If you can call that a job, yeah.
I know, it's a tough job. Someone's got to do it, right?
Exactly. Thank you for including us in that. It was fabulous.
Yeah. So tell me, like, how did you guys get started? And also, how did you get started working as a team together?
Well, I started out as a diver. When I was in high school, I took diving lessons. I was on the swim team, actually, at the time. And some of my swimming buddies were divers. So I took a diving class. And I've never done anything else since. I've been a professional diver all my life. I taught scuba diving when I went to college and put myself through college teaching diving. And after I graduated with a degree in zoology, I started looking for ways to use my zoology degree and also my knowledge of diving to make a living. And eventually, underwater photography presented itself as a good way to do that. And I think that I'm extraordinarily lucky because I found something that I was good at. I mean, I'm not good at everything. I'm good at a few things, and it just happens that I'm really good at diving. And surprisingly, I'm actually pretty good at filmmaking. And I didn't really know that until the last few years. But I've learned that, you know, I found what I was good at, and I'm really blessed for that.
That's well, great. I think your observational skills have come into play to a large extent.
Well, maybe.
And your patience with wildlife, not always with me, but with wildlife.
Michelle's path was very much different than mine.
So. Yeah. A lot of people give credit to the Jacques Cousteau series and Sea Hunt for motivating them to get involved in diving and even inspire them to become filmmakers. And to be honest, that was not the case for me. I, from early childhood, wanted to be a nurse. That was where my passion was. And I went to nursing school in Kansas City and worked as a nurse for almost 20 years. Mm. In the meantime, I decided to learn how to scuba dive. I was dating somebody who was a sport diver, one of the doctors that I worked with. And I thought, well, this would be something fun for us to do together. So I signed up for diving lessons, and that was how I met Howard. In May of 1975, he was my instructor. It was a while before we started seeing each other on a social basis, but eventually we did. And one thing led to another, and we got married in August of 1981.
I feel sorry for the doctor that you were dating.
Well, don't feel sorry for him. He became a plastic surgeon, and I think was very successful and was just fine. And Howard used to tease and say that my parents would wonder why the heck I stopped dating a would-be plastic surgeon to go out with my diving instructor. But I have no complaints. It's worked out really well. I continued to work as a nurse for some years after we got married. But in 1990, Howard's career was really taking off with him producing his own films, producing and directing and writing his own films. And it was just more than he could handle himself. And we decided to give it a try to work together. And so in January of 1991, I left my nursing career and joined the family business. We talked about changing the name of the company from Howard Hall Productions to something else, but he was pretty well established by
Michelle
then.
Michelle Hall Productions.
No, Up the Hall Productions was one of the suggestions. but it's worked out really well. We work together very well. We have dissimilar strengths. So the things that I'm good at and enjoy doing are not necessarily the things that Howard is good at or enjoys doing, and vice versa. So it meshes together really well, and it's been successful for us.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been showing my recent film, Gratitude Revealed, to nurses. We did one in Mount Sinai. I've got a big one coming up at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore in an auditorium that'll see 2,000 people. But what I've learned also as a patient is that it's the nurses that make the hospital run. And I think the organizational skill set that you probably learned being a nurse is critical to being a really great producer.
Absolutely. I totally agree with everything that you just said. And I'm so glad that you're able to reach out to the nursing community with your films and that they can benefit from your wisdom. I think that nurses are very often undervalued, and it's certainly been a stressful situation the last few years through the pandemic. Yeah. I know that a lot of nurses have left the field and are feeling burned out, as the phrase goes.
Yeah.
So it's wonderful to be able to give back and have the nursing community feel gratitude.
Yeah. No, it's really beautiful because, like, you know, after the screening, it simply gives them the opportunity to express gratitude for each other, you know.
Absolutely.
Which they don't really get a chance to do, and to be respected and to be honored and to be acknowledged, to be seen, all that stuff, you know. And obviously you don't go into nursing to make a lot of money. So the folks that are doing it are really special, and it's great for them to get that kind of feedback. So it's really great. Plus, look, it made you a great film producer. Curious.
Skill set.
Yeah. So Howard, I think both of us, you know, as filmmakers, you know, we've always really wanted to explore, I think, high resolution, right? And, like, you know, we migrated in the evolution of filmmaking, right, from 16 millimeter to 35 and IMAX, and et cetera. And I'm wondering if the desire for high resolution, is it to turn people on to the beauty of nature and the detail and the wonder, making the invisible visible? And also, is it perhaps to blow people away in the IMAX theater so that they fall in love with nature and shift their behavior in order to protect it?
I think it's really all of those things. As you know, the world is changing and natural systems are in decline. We're losing species all the time. Habitats are disappearing. And so I feel an obligation to capture these environments and the animals that live in them in the highest resolution possible, because we want people to know what it was like. And for years, I shot in 16 millimeter. I have hundreds of hours of 16 millimeter film of amazing animals. I made a number of films using that footage. But now 16 millimeter is not good enough to run on even high definition television, let alone 4K. And so all that footage is basically obsolete, which is a tragedy in many ways. People are not going to watch it. And if we were to make films with it, they would be substandard visually. So I'm just trying to stay ahead of that as much as possible. As soon as HD became available, I moved into HD and started shooting with that. When 4K became available, I started shooting in 4K, and now I'm shooting in 8K. And who knows what the resolutions, what resolutions are going to be acceptable in the future. But I just want to be, I want the images I capture to be good for as long as possible, because I know things are going to continue to change. And I feel it's my calling to capture the wild environment, especially underwater, in and depict it as it is in the most beautiful way possible. So it's kind of interesting because high resolution doesn't work for everything. If you're making a feature film or a television film, if you shoot it in too high a resolution, then people can see that the sets are artificial and that there's makeup right on the actors and that there's just too much detail. And it they see the flaws in the creation of a fictional work. With natural history, that's not the case. You want to show them as much as possible. There's nothing you're trying to hide. You're capturing the environment in the highest quality possible to show them what it is like. And it's still not as good as reality, but right. I think it's important to capture it in the highest quality possible.
Yeah, I share that point of view as well, because for me, I think that those rhythms and patterns and the beauty of nature is like a secret language that motivates us to do the right thing. You know, if we fall in love with something, you'll protect it. And it's also, in many cases, I think, Howard, it's almost better than reality, you know, because if you're showing like a macro, micro shot of something, your eyes can't necessarily focus that close up. If it's a time lapse or slow motion, you can't see it in that way either. And if that can open people's heart, if it can broaden your perspective, to realize that you're not this arrogant Homo sapien species, that you're the center of the universe, and other critters are as valuable as you are, right? Because we're connected to all of it. And that, I think, is like perhaps the core problem with this whole quote-unquote environmental crisis, right? This disconnection from nature, that it's a separate thing. And you've been, I think, championing this consciousness to protect the ocean and making people understand that the ocean is us, right? So let me ask you this question. You've got, when you're doing the IMAX film, we talked about the fact that you're going to, like, you know, bust your butt carrying, like, you know, giant cameras. You know, Michelle is like organizing like a military operation of logistics, trying to ship all this stuff around the world. How do you eventually settle into that more kind of spiritual place of wonder and awe, that you are a childlike wonder that there you are, finally you got all the gear there, you went through all the logistics, all the travel, all the hassle, and now you're finally there, and now you're able to do what you feel is your mission in life and your calling. How do you settle into that?
Well, I wish I could say that I see it from the same perspective that you do. For me, really, the wonderful thing about making 70 millimeter IMAX films, which we captured, especially the 3D films, with an enormous camera system that out of the water weighed over 1,200 pounds and only ran for 3 minutes. It was simply the most impractical underwater camera system ever invented. And it made a lot of noise. So animals that were sensitive to noise, they fled the noise, and the camera would make noise for 5 seconds before it's even capturing an image. So it was a very difficult camera system to use. But I loved that. I loved the format because it was so hard. And it gave me a reason to take my crew, which were all extremely excellent divers, professional divers, to take them underwater with this gigantic camera system, gigantic tripods, heavy weights, lighting systems, and all this gear, take that down and try to capture beautiful images with it, was enormously challenging. And I love that. I love the technical part of making that all work. It led us to developing different kinds of diving equipment, developing underwater communications gear, all kinds of things. I love that. And in the IMAX 3D format especially, trying to capture animal behavior was sort of frustrating because everything associated with the camera was trying to make the animals run away or was making it difficult.
Right.
But when you see it in the theater, when it actually works, you see it in the theater, the resolution was so high and the perception of 3D was so good that I saw things in the theater that I didn't see when I was actually making the film. That happened often.
Right.
That was really fun.
So look, it's good we have different perspectives. I think everyone in the world should have a different perspective, which is really healthy. But it's funny. I also enjoyed those technical hurdles. Like now when I travel, you know, and I go to baggage claim and there's like only one or two cases, I go, uh-oh, where's all the stuff? It was always a minimum of 12 cases, you know, in an AC grabbing it and having a hassle. And those production stills where three or four of us were sitting on like 20 cases of gear. And I also loved the challenge of it. Yet it was a big physical effort to move things around. I also think we both shared the challenge of having to invent motors and gears and all kinds of stuff. I know you did. You invented a motor for the 16 camera that could like run longer than a windup. I had to invent a DC stop motion motor, you know, back in 1975. To take a Mitchell camera, you know, old-fashioned camera outdoors to do time-lapse because there was no such thing as a stop-motion motor because they're all used to shoot animation like, you know, Disney sells underneath a light stand. And I look back now and I love those challenges as well, you know? And I used to dream, Howard, that like if my dad owned a company, I wanted him to own Kodak. Because that was like the biggest barrier was the cost of film. So, you know, when you were talking about IMAX, you know, a 3-minute roll of film, $5,000 a roll. And I hope for the young people that are listening, perhaps, to understand that they can buy like a small little memory card the size of a quarter that maybe holds 3 to 4 hours of high resolution film. You can stick it in your pocket. You know, every minute of film was a pound or a pound and a half, you know, and a roll, I mean, 35 millimeter, you know, a 4-minute roll of film was $400, but it also weighed 5 or 6 pounds, you know? And so one of the biggest cases we used to travel with, right, was film. That was like the heaviest thing.
When we went into the field with our IMAX 3D system, we would each time, and we would typically do about 5 expeditions or 6 expeditions to make a film. Each time we went into the film field, we took 1,000 pounds of film with us. And in the course of making an IMAX 3D film, we would spend over $1 million in film and processing. But
right.
What's really remarkable is that today we do that with a camera system that in the underwater housing weighs 30 pounds and costs mm-hmm. nothing to run. So
right.
It's almost mind-boggling how much the technology has influenced filmmaking.
Yeah, so one of the reasons it inspired me to do time-lapse was the fact that, you know, I could spend a month or two shooting one roll of film and get the experience of lighting and chasing the light and looking at phenomena. Early on, you know, Michelle, you said something about Howard I think that's really key in terms of his talent and his gift is the fact that he's really good at observation. I think observation is the key to learning. And it's that intersection between art and science. You know, scientists can do observation and come up with a scientific method, a theory, a thesis that needs to be proven by repeated trials. Any artist can look at that and just really kind of wonder, like, the magic of why it happens and tell a different kind of story, you know, that isn't grounded in having it to be like a repeatable hypothesis that can be proven as a thesis, which kind of takes a little bit of the wonder and awe and mystery out of it. What do you guys think?
Well, one of the things that I think one of Howard's big talents, I believe, is, as you've recapped and as I said earlier, is his ability to observe and to learn. One of the things that surprised me as I got more involved in filmmaking and spending time with and talking with marine biologists is very often how little time they are able to spend in the field. And because of our filmmaking and the hours and hours and hours that we spend on location and the hours and hours that that my film crew, including Howard, spends underwater observing, is how much we've been able to learn about things and learn about animal behaviors that sometimes the scientists who study them have not had the opportunity to see because they don't have the chance to get out in the field. So we have been able to collaborate with scientists, marine biologists, and provide them with imagery, whether it be still images or digital film capture, that have helped them better understand the behaviors of the animals that they're studying. And that is part of what has been very rewarding for us, for me, and has contributed, I think, a lot to the success of our films. The focus of our films typically has been looking at animal behavior and looking at capturing sequences of animals doing things. And sometimes it's things that we've read about because scientists have learned about them, marine biologists have learned about them. And sometimes it's things that we were not expecting, but happened, and we were able, Howard was able to capture the footage because of the amount of time that we're able to spend in the water.
So I remember we did a couple of short little clips. We were experimenting with this idea of doing a series about biomimicry. And actually, you know, you were generous enough to let us play with some of your shots, like the goby fish and things like that. Do you feel that biomimicry could be, in a sense, a moral compass for us to live our lives as a society and a culture?
Well, everything that we do as a species, as a culture, as individuals, is greatly influenced by the species we evolved from. I think people don't appreciate that a lot of the things that we do has roots in very primitive ancestors. For example, you have when you feel good, sometimes when you feel really good, your body secretes serotonin. And that's the purpose of that particular drug, is to make you feel good when you do something well. Your body secretes serotonin. I recently read that flatworms have serotonin in their blood. Now, why would a flatworm have serotonin in his blood? Does that mean that it feels good occasionally and sometimes doesn't? Is feeling good, feeling happy, is that strictly something that belongs to humans? Hmm. Or is it something that belongs to all animals? If you've ever owned a dog, you can tell that dogs have good days and bad days. They have fun. They feel embarrassment. They dream. You see all those things if you've owned a dog. And I believe that they're common to everything. Yeah. I read just a last week that a scientific paper that indicates that fish can recognize themselves in a mirror. And because they can recognize themselves, does that mean they're self-aware? And I believe that it does mean that, and that we have, as a species, been looking down at the natural world as creatures that are below us, that don't feel things, that feeling is strictly a human attribute. And I don't believe that's true. I think that it's common to all animals, and there's so many things that we do that if you look at it, animals do in the natural world too, and probably for the same reasons. It makes them feel good. It makes them feel happy. It gives them a sense of adventure. Another good example, when it comes to adventure, we think that's something that just humans enjoy. Humans just, they like a sense of adventure, but we don't usually attribute that to animals. But I was in Alaska a couple of years ago, and I saw a deer swimming across a bay that was 3 miles wide, very cold water. When it reached the other side, it was so cold, it had great difficulty standing up. It took 45 minutes before it could get to its feet and actually walk away. Now, why would a deer jump in the water and swim 3 miles across a cold bay? Why would they do that? And I believe the reason is that it had a sense of adventure. It wanted to go there to see what was on the other side, just like human explorers went places to see what was on the other side. Mm-hmm. And it may seem that that's really anthropomorphic, but in actuality, if you don't have a sense of adventure, then you're going to stay in your cave and you're going to eat what you've compiled there, and you're never going to go out because going outside is dangerous. Adventure is dangerous. But without it, without that sense of adventure, that desire to go across the bay, you're not going to meet members of the opposite sex. You're not going to disperse your DNA widely and mix it up with a wider population. So there is a selective advantage to the sense of adventure that we feel and animals feel as well.
That's pretty thought-provoking. I share that, though, because I think DNA is, you know, I think DNA is life force energy, and it wants to go forward. And in a way, it utilizes things like beauty to coordinate or manipulate behavior in order for, you know, evolution to occur. And it isn't just about sex. I remember I was filming the monarchs up in the highlands of Mexico where they winter. And I was asking our monarch scientific expert, like, what motivates their behavior? And I remember he said, well, you know, it's all about, you know, risk and reward. And like a little kid, I go, why? And he goes, well, because, you know, they want to survive. And I go, well, why? Well, because they want to reproduce. And I go, why? And I thought he was going to say, well, it's all about sex. But instead he said, well, he said, because nothing lasts forever. Everything in the universe wears out. So it's from a scientific point of view, it's a means of overcoming entropy. You know, mountains wear out. The sun's going to wear out, right? And that really blew my mind, because then I kind of realized that life is a force of energy that is perpetual, that can overcome entropy, because it isn't about this one body, you know, having to like live forever. You know, we are a chain and a link of life from our ancestry to the future. And what a genius invention reproduction is when you think about it, that you don't succumb to the fact that, yeah, everything wears out.
Well, I think it's an interesting perspective, because DNA is a molecule. It's a very large molecule as molecules go. But we think of our computers as being really smart and really fast and, you know, able to assimilate terabytes of data. But when you think about it, you can take everything that is needed to make a human being, not only make a human being, but its ability to walk, its ability to communicate, its ability to learn languages, many of the behaviors that we have, all that you can code on a single molecule that is so small that you can't see it with the naked eye. Yeah. How many terabytes of material is that on something you can't even see?
Yeah.
So it's an amazing molecule. I think we all take it for granted because, you know, it's part of us and it's part of everything that lives, but it's a magical thing. And it controls our lives, and it controls the lives of everything on this planet.
I just learned that recently, by the way, because, you know, I've been like a vegetarian since college, And I thought, like, you know, I would never have to worry about cardiovascular problems. And I recently discovered I've got to go in actually on Monday for a stent because genetically I've got a terrible history, family history of, you know, cardiovascular disease. It was a shocker to hear that because I've been living a very, not only healthy, but environmentally conscious diet, you know, for my body and for the planet. And, you know, it was like a natural thing to do. It wasn't like a hard decision to make. And I've just kind of enjoyed doing one good thing in my life, which is eating natural food and being healthy, right? So, yeah, the genes are pretty powerful, you know. No matter, regardless of what I did for 50 years in my diet and thinking that I'm going to be a different lifestyle, different diet than my parents, I wasn't able to avoid it.
No, I think that what happens to us medically is 85% our DNA and 15% our lifestyle. And so if you had led a less healthy lifestyle, you might be in worse condition. But
I might not be in this podcast with you.
But it's undoubtedly the DNA that controls so much of how we live and our health and our well-being. So you have to get a little bit lucky with the mixture of DNA that you get.
Yeah. So you mentioned serotonin before. I'm thinking about the worms. Maybe that's why gardeners love to garden. Maybe they're picking up some of the serotonin that's coming out of the soil with all the worms and stuff. But I also get that really warm feeling when I watch your work, because I think that in addition to capturing behavior, you know, natural behavior, which tells a great story and it really drives the narrative, it's also really spiritual for me to be able to, a beautiful shot you have of that stingray swimming upside down, and the elegance of that, the beauty of that, the mystery of it, almost the otherworldly aspect of it. So my question is, like, when you're filming it, do you feel that, or is that something you experience more either in the cutting room or where you're, or when you're sharing it with an audience?
Well, I think that that's what has drawn me to the ocean so much. When I was young, I wanted to explore. I wanted to have adventure. I wanted to see things that nobody had seen before. And there was few places on the planet where you could actually do that. I lived in California, you know. Where are you going to go and see something that nobody's seen before, except right in the water? There are certainly places in, you know, the Amazon and high mountains and so forth, but I had no means of getting there. If I had the means, I might have gone that way. But the ocean presented itself as an environment that is largely unexplored, especially 50 years ago when I started. And I could go underwater and I had the sense of being someplace that maybe nobody has been before. And in many cases, that was true. The sense of solitude that you can have diving within a few miles of Los Angeles, is the sense of solitude can be overwhelming when you're underwater. You feel that, and just being able to go down to the bottom and put your hands in the sand, you know, and realize that nobody's ever done this before, or maybe nobody's ever done this before. I find that to be wonderful, and being able to capture images of animals that nobody has seen before, which I've been lucky enough to do a few times, mm-hmm, or just capture animal behaviors that nobody knew anything about. It fulfills that sense of adventure that I always dreamed of having when I was young, and it's magical. I love it.
I think it's multifaceted. Sometimes when I go diving, or if I see Howard in the water, not looking through the viewfinder, not looking through the camera, and just experiencing it, that's such a special moment on the end. When you do put your eye to the viewfinder, you sometimes lose the sense of what's happening because you're so focused on just the small bit that you're seeing or on the technical aspects. And then when you are able to look at the imagery later, you say, wow, I didn't realize that was happening. I didn't realize that the animal was doing that, or that this was going on in the background. So as I say, multifaceted. You just experience having the privilege of being able to experience all of it. Of late, I am taking less and less still pictures. My background in terms of image capture has been still photography, but also capturing imagery, video of Howard working. And I still enjoy that, but I really relish just looking around on my dives. And
it's tough. Because like I know when we're on location and like let's say you're underwater, I mean you're it's amazing like what you're experiencing and what you're looking at, but there's a part of at least my brain that's concerned about resources. You might be thinking about like how much air do I have left or how much time with the crew and this and that and gasoline on the boat and the sun's going down and you know there's all those factors that are kind of always like in the background because it isn't 100% bliss, you know?
No.
You know, I'm in a helicopter flying over Mount Cook. I'm going, oh my God, it's sunrise. It's incredible. The highest point in New Zealand. But I'm worried about how much time we have left. How do we get back to a safe landing? You know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and it's like a struggle between I want more of this, but I got to worry about that. So that's why I kind of asked that question, because sometimes for me, because I'm thinking logistically at the same time, I don't really have the oh wow moment until we sometimes get back. And also I've captured stuff that scientists went oh wow about, like when we filmed the bats, for example, and it was like a baby breastfeeding on the mama, probably only like an hour old. When I first saw that shot go by in real time, I thought like its guts were hanging out because this thing had no hair on it. You know, it looked gross. And it was just a flash, you know, and I go, oh my God, what was that? And then you realize, oh, it's a baby, you know?
And so one of the things, if I could just interrupt for a second, yeah. Louis, one of the things to sort of contradict what I was saying a moment ago is that by having the image capture and looking at it later, you're able to relive that moment. And one of my favorite images, still images that I took and looking at video that Howard captured was when we were on location for you in Tahiti. So we're diving with the humpback whales and Howard is filming this humpback whale. And I was taking still photos, not using the flash so that I didn't flash his frame. And I have this fabulous still image of Howard with a humpback whale. And there's a sort of a vortex from the surface coming down as the whale was descending a bit. And then when we looked at his video that he'd captured, there it was. So it's just this
vortex. You mean the vortex was there?
Yes. So yeah. I had taken a still image of him with the whale as he was filming it, and it's just one of the not sure what the word is, juxtaposes. That's probably not right. The right word.
Juxtaposition.
Juxtaposition. Thank you. Of him filming and me capturing the image of him. And I have you to thank for that. Aww. And being in Tahiti, working on that moving art film for you.
Okay, so how do you think you capture wonder and awe in your work?
Well, I go someplace, first of all, that's wonderful and awesome. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's the beauty of this being a job. It's my job is to go to wonderful places, experience and capture beauty. And, you know, it's kind of ridiculous thinking this is a way you make a living. It's why you have a living, you know. Right. But for me, it's been the same thing. I've been blessed by having a profession that insists that I go to these wonderful places and experiencing these wonderful things. A few years ago, we made a film called Coral Reef Adventure. And during the production of that film, we did because the film was called Coral Reef Adventure, we wanted to have some serious adventure. So we decided we were going to do a series of deep dives, highly technical deep dives far beyond the maximum depth of sport divers, and look for something totally new. And we did a series of dives to between 300 and 400 feet in French Polynesia and in Fiji. And the wonderful thing about going to those depths is that you can be absolutely certain that nobody's ever been there before. And anything you see there is something that nobody's ever seen before. And it was astounding to me getting down there how incredibly beautiful it was. Mm. There was perspectives at those depths that you don't get even diving to 100 feet. We saw things that nobody had ever seen. One of the people we were filming, Dr. Richard Pyle, was able to identify fish species that nobody had ever seen before. And he actually identified sometimes as many as 4 new species of fish on a single dive.
Wow.
I mean, it was amazing. And being able to do that was really one of the really funny things about making that film was that because of the depth, the camera malfunctioned 50% of the time for a variety of reasons. So we would devote an entire day to making a dive that was going to be 30 minutes at 350 feet. And we'd get down there and there was a little cork clutch in the camera that would compress too much and that would cause the film to break. And that happened half the time. And we would then have to go through 3.5 hours of decompression to come back from the dive, and we have nothing. And a lot of people felt really bad for me because we had devoted so much energy and so much time and a certain amount of risk to going to these ridiculous depths and only to have the camera fail. And those were my favorite dives because on those dives, I turned the camera on, it jammed. I've got 30 minutes to look around. Have all the support of all these people and all this equipment, you know, that is necessary for making those kinds of dives. And here I am able to actually enjoy it and look it around. So on those dives, when the camera failed, I was able to actually take in the wonder and beauty of being in a place that was amazing, totally amazing, and where nobody's ever been before. And that was really wonderful.
On the other hand, as we've talked about, our films tend to focus on animal behavior sequences. And we recently had the opportunity to screen a film that you mentioned earlier, Soul of the Ocean. We screened it at actually recently twice to 2 different groups of folks. One was a group in Maui. We were attending the Whale Tales Conference. And it was just amazing to me. The room was filled with 550 people, standing room only, which was just really fabulous for us to see that kind of an audience. And so many of the comments afterwards were from people who were seasoned divers who said, I've never seen some of that before. Right. They would reference particular sequences and say how emotional they got watching it. All of that just warmed my heart so much because that's part of my goal as a filmmaker is to be able to bring a finished product to an audience that may not be divers, or even if they're seasoned divers, as many of these people were, they may not have seen this type of behavior before. And the wonder and awe that they felt in viewing our film brought so much wonder and awe to me and satisfaction. It was just really heartwarming. People telling me that they teared up during the film because of the sequences that they were seeing and the music that they were hearing, having been composed by our fabulous composer, Alan Williams, was just really wonderful.
I've had that similar experience where people tear up, you know, and it's not a sad movie. And you kind of wonder, like, well, why is that? And I feel that it's because, again, of that disconnection we have from nature, that people have a homecoming in their soul, that it's been so long since I've been there where I am, you know, part of, you know, this universe, this world, you know, and instead of like this person who maybe lives in an apartment, I go to work, I get a paycheck, I'm on this little treadmill of a thing called life. And every once in a while, you get a real shocking reminder that, you know, this is my home. This is my real home. And that feeling of homecoming is something we all want, right? When you actually, when we come back from travel, that feeling when you come into your own bed for the first time feels great, right? We all love that feeling of homecoming. And that, I think, generates the tears, you know, because we don't realize how long we've been gone from ourselves.
Right. You know. So the other festival that we presented the film at recently was the Santa Barbara International Film Festival, which is a very broad outreach. And we just felt so fortunate that our film was selected to be screened. We attended one of the screenings, and that was another instance where, except in this instance, many of the attendees were not divers. Mm-hmm. So being able to show them what exists in the ocean. We were in Santa Barbara, just off the coast of California, and right. People look out to the ocean all the time, and they just see this surface of water. And what we were able to show them is what lives under that surface. And so many people said, "Thank you for showing me what lives down there," increasing their awareness.
Yeah, well, that's a beautiful metaphor. Like what lives below the surface. You called it the soul of the ocean. So why did you call it the soul of the ocean?
Well, it's a bit of a story, but for the majority of my career, I've been making films for other people. I've directed 16 episodes of Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom back when Marlon Perkins was, you know, the featured star. And most of those films that we made back then, you know, they centered around, you know, the danger and the risk and, you know, the terrifying stuff that could happen to you underwater. I mean, moray eels, you know, with teeth this big, you know, and scary stuff, sharks. You know, that's what people wanted. I mean, people want, right, you know, the thrill, you know, even though it really doesn't exist that way.
And, right.
And so I spent a lot of time trying to capture images that were spectacular in that sense, predation sequences, because that's what sold. But eventually I realized that the reason it was so hard to capture those kinds of images was because they don't happen that often. And you would think, well, in the ocean, obviously big fish eat little fish. That's how everything works. Well, it isn't really how everything works. There certainly is predation, you know, animals have to eat just like we have to eat. But in fact, cold-blooded animals have to eat far less than we do. So a shark may only eat once every couple of weeks. And for you to be down there to see a shark attack something and eat it would be really unusual. And most divers will go a lifetime and never see that actually happen.
Right.
But what you do see when you're underwater, everywhere you look, is you see cooperation between species.
Yeah.
You see symbiotic behaviors. And that's the soul of the ocean.
Yeah.
It's the cooperation between animals working together to make their ecosystem work. And it's not just mindless instinct. There's more to it than that. A lot of the behaviors animals do, they do because they want to do it. Cleaning behavior is a good example, where you see fish plucking parasites and bits of algae off of other fish. It's extremely common. You see it almost every time you go diving. And it's not necessary. I mean, those biologists have proven that these animals can survive without being cleaned. So they do it because they like it. You know, think about that. The fish do it because they like it.
Yeah.
And so that's,
I love it.
That's what we've tried to show, that the ocean is a much calmer, gentler place than people like me have been depicting it for the last 50 years.
Right. So obviously we have that shared perspective, I think, because if you look at the film I did, Wings of Life, about the pollinators, it's those little guys that make the world go round. You know, without the pollinators, you don't have fruits, nuts, vegetables for animals and us to eat. And are the bees doing it in order to help the flower? Or are they just doing it to bring nectar back to feed their babies, you know? But in any event, they are enabling each other to thrive and to flourish and to reproduce and to live. And we are the beneficiaries of that. And we're just on the outside of that for whole interchange, right? Because what we have to do is just avoid putting on pesticides and kill the bees that, you know, make that destroy it. But I would say that I want to applaud you for that, because so much of natural history filmmaking, or let's just say documentary nature films, have been about fear and anxiety. And Shark Week is still the most popular thing that ratings, you know, score on Discovery. And I applaud both of you for taking a different path to show people that not every encounter in nature is going to be a shark wanting to eat you, which creates so much fear. You know, all the time people go in the ocean, I go, are there sharks? Are you kidding me? Like, you'd be lucky to see a shark. How many shark attacks are there in the world? How many car accidents are there in the world? What are the odds here? Is it one or two shark attacks a year? Maybe? I don't know.
There's an average of about 5 fatalities a year.
Yeah. I think it's great that we're able to tell a better story, a bigger story, a grander story. It's actually a grander story because it's like billions of interactions that are occurring all the time at the bottom of the food chain, not at the top of the food chain. And that complexity is something I think that we're both filled with curiosity, wonder, and awe. It also, I think, skews a little bit more towards the feminine as opposed to the masculine, macho storytelling of predator versus prey, survival of the fittest, which we both know Darwin got hijacked in terms of that story by the imperialists of the 1930s trying to justify, you know, colonial invasions in third world countries. That was, oh, let's grab that thing, survival of the fittest, and run with it. Teddy Roosevelt did that. But he was a botanist, Darwin. And most of his writings and most of his illustrations are about plants. And what are plants about? Complex, symbiotic relationships, right? That are boring as hell to some people, but incredibly fascinating. So anyways, now I understand why you did Soul of the Ocean. We need to look below the surface, realize that there's a billion interactions going on, and all of that is really the thing that supports life and supports us as well.
Well, I thought, you know, making Soul of the Ocean with this sort of kinder, gentler, you know, perspective would be a dangerous move, because who's going to want to watch that? You know, who's going to want to be told that sharks really don't eat people, you know, but I've been amazed at how well it's been received, how well the message has been received. I think people are a little bit tired of being told, you know, that the world is such a dangerous place, and they kind of like the idea that it's maybe not. I mean, all the longest lived animals in the world live in the ocean. I mean, there's sharks that swim around down there that have been alive, that were alive 400 years ago. I mean, can you imagine a shark that lives for 400 years? And there's fish off the coast of California here, rockfish that can be 160, 200 years old. How do you survive for 200 years if you're constantly being attacked by sharks? You know, it's just not the way it is. It's a much more complicated environment than we've been led to believe.
Yeah. Well, it's easy, I think, to... in the entertainment world, in Hollywood, to press the fear button. I mean, most of the movies, most of the content, most of the channels are really about fear and anxiety, which is why both of us have stopped, I think, pitching broadcasters or cable channels, because there really isn't a platform for it, which is why I'm so thrilled to let folks know that on the Louie channel, which we're going to announce April 20th, we're going to have, you know, some of your most amazing films on it, to be able to celebrate life and tell a different story. And I want to curate the best of the best. You happen to be the best underwater, you know, filmmakers in the world. And I think it's about time that people are given a choice. One isn't better than the other, but like there's McDonald's and then there's like healthy food. I mean, let the customer figure out where they want to go. What's nutrition?
You just lost
the
sponsor, Louis.
But what's good for your soul and what's good for your brain? You know, do you want more fear? And fear creates cortisol. Cortisol, you know, is bad for your body. We want to create a little bit more of that serotonin that makes you feel good. And that's actually physiologically better for you. That's not the reason why you watch it, but it's an indirect benefit that I think adds efficacy to the fact that we need to tell a new story. We need to tell a better story. And I think because of our independence, we're able to do that. And that has a lot to do, I think, with like sticking to your passion and sticking to your mission and sticking to your sense of what is right and wrong.
But it is why people watch the films. I've had people come to me and say, you know, I watch your films on moving art to help me sleep. Yeah. So they're sleeping through some of it, but it calms them. Yeah. People who are having trouble sleeping, falling asleep, it calms them as they watch it. And because these are hour-long films with just some music and no narration, they don't feel like they have to follow some story. They just, it's meditative for them. They relax into it and are able to fall asleep.
And we found out that people, Netflix doesn't give you the data, but they did share with me the fact that people watch the same episode every day. Now that's something highly unusual in the world of viewing television, that you would watch the same episode every day, because they have turned it into a practice. Yeah. You know, although I don't think we should be proud to say that our films put you to sleep.
No, only sometimes, only if you're laying in bed and trying to go to sleep. I think for people who are going through chemotherapy or other types of medical procedures that are potentially are stressful, for them to be able to watch films like these where it just helps them calm down.
Yeah. Yeah. And we have clinical trials at UCSD where on the oncology unit, combining the imagery with aromatherapy, and we're going to hopefully get some results on that. And I just finished a clinical trial at the Pacific Neuroscience Institute, where it was a combination of the nature imagery with psilocybin to treat alcohol addiction and trauma. And the combination of the two had better results than just the psilocybin by itself, which, you know, there's 60 universities now doing studies on quote unquote magic mushrooms, you know, to treat trauma and addiction. So I think we're finally waking up, hopefully, to a brave new world. Again, my analogy to fast food, I think, is good, you know, because for a long time people ate that stuff and had no idea. For a long time people smoked cigarettes and had no idea. I think someday there will be really a lot of hardcore evidence that watching a bunch of horror films and watching films that have a lot of murder and violence and torture and all of that is, certainly very unhealthy for your body, you know, as well as your mind.
Common sense to me. I mean,
yeah, completely. Yeah. Which is why I don't watch horror films. I don't want anybody tracking dirt through my brain, you know?
Right.
It's like too much. Well, so let me ask you, what is your definition of beauty?
I'd have to say nature. I think that art is an imitation of nature for the most part. Mm-hmm. People depicting things artistically that exist in nature, trying to capture the beauty of nature. So for me, you know, pristine environments, or as close to pristine as possible, are beautiful. They're almost always beautiful, whether it's, you know, an austere desert scene, or whether it's an underwater kelp forest, or whether it's, you know, a field of flowers, you know, on the side of a hill. You know, I think that, talking about DNA again, but I think our DNA has predisposed us to appreciate beauty, and that beauty is, you know, natural beauty for the most part.
I agree. I would describe it as nature's operating instructions, you know. We're hardwired. Yeah. Did you realize none of us go to school to learn about beauty? Audiences or filmmakers, right? There's a certain general common agreement about what is beautiful, right? And if we weren't hardwired to be motivated by beauty, I don't think we would love puppies and kittens and babies because they're all cute. And they're cute because you got to nurture them. You got to take care of them for life to go forward.
But if we're hardwired to appreciate beauty, where did that hardwiring come from? And if you have to admit that it came from our ancestors, then there's a whole, world of animals out there that actually appreciate beauty. And you have to ask yourself, does a bird stand on top of a tree looking out at a field of flowers and sing its head off just because, it's supposed to, or does it really appreciate what it sees? And I think that animals, if we can appreciate beauty, if we're hardwired to appreciate beauty, the natural world is filled with animals that do that.
What is your definition for gratitude?
That's kind of difficult. I guess I'd say being lucky. I mean, I feel like I've been extraordinarily lucky in my life. I've been lucky to find a thing that I do that I'm good at. If I'd been born in Montana, I might never have entered the ocean to begin with, and I might never realized how good I am at diving and making films about marine life. I just got lucky. And I'm lucky I met Michelle because she cooks me breakfast.
And I produce the films that you direct and film.
So I think in many ways, when people do things that you appreciate and you feel gratitude for, you're lucky, you're blessed. So I think that it's the feeling gratitude is the knowledge that you've been given this gift of being lucky. And of course you can't feel lucky all the time, because if you felt lucky all the time, you wouldn't know what it meant. You can only feel it, you can only feel gratitude when you experience times when you don't feel that way. You can't feel good if you never feel bad. Right. So, I think that I'd say, my feeling of gratitude stems from being lucky. And I feel gratitude for that all the time.
I think of satisfaction, and I think of appreciating being satisfied. Not everything is satisfying, but if I can look for the satisfaction that I find in a circumstance and appreciate that satisfaction, then I'm grateful for it.
And one last word definition. How do you feel about wonder? What is wonder to you?
Wonder is what motivates me to turn the corner, to keep going.
Steinbeck, when he wrote East of Eden, he said that under somewhat extraordinarily beautiful conditions in the natural world, when the sun seemed to be especially bright and the flowers seemed to be especially colorful, he'd experience what he called a glory. And when you feel that way, when you're out in the wild and all of a sudden it's just so perfect, it's so beautiful that it literally takes your breath away, that's wonder. Yeah.
Thank you both for this incredible conversation. I think people are going to love learning about, the pioneering, adventurous, journeys you do with underwater filmmaking, but also the fact that there's a deeper conscious intention and outcome that comes from it, which is really turning people on to beauty and to protect the planet, to love each other, to be compassionate, all those good things. And the fact that you do it, the fact that it happens unknowingly is another thing that I'm grateful for. You know, you don't know how people are going to be touched. Like you said, someone said, well, it helps my kid go to sleep. That was like not a direct intention, but there's all these outcomes that occur that are beautiful reminders that, you know, the energy we put out helps people, which is really great.
Well, Louis, thank you for this opportunity to share our story and for leading the way, because over the decades that we've known each other, and I remember some of the early days at Jackson Hole Wildlife Film Festival, where I think we first met decades ago, you have led the way in so many ways, and we appreciate that so much, your friendship and what you've done for the world.
Oh, thank you. I also want to thank my great crew here, Sarah, Courtney, Sam, Annie, Kurt, Greta, and the Fetzer Institute for helping us, you know, have these really beautiful, deep conversations with all kinds of remarkable but crazy people. And thank you so much for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Louis.